All right, if you would get to Psalm 25 with me, I'd love to read it for us. In you, Lord my God, I put my trust. I trust in you. Do not let me be put to shame, nor let my enemies triumph over me. No one who hopes in you will ever be put to shame. But shame will come on those who are treacherous without cause. Show me your ways, Lord. Teach me your paths. Guide me in your truth and teach me. For you are God, my Savior, and my hope is in you all day long. Remember, Lord, your great mercy and love, for they are from of old. Do not remember the sins of my youth and my rebellious ways. According to your love, remember me. For you, Lord, are good. Good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, he instructs sinners in his ways. He guides the humble in what is right and teaches them his way. All the ways of the Lord are loving and faithful toward those who keep the demands of his covenant. For the sake of your name, Lord, forgive my iniquity, though it is great. Who then are those who fear the Lord? He will instruct them in the ways that they should choose. They will spend their days in prosperity, and their descendants will inherit the land. The Lord confides in those who fear him. He makes his covenant known to them. My eyes are ever on the Lord, for only he will release my feet from the snare. Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. Relieve the troubles of my heart and free me from my anguish. Look on my affliction and my distress and take away all my sins. See how numerous are my enemies and how fiercely they hate me. Guard my life and rescue me. Do not let me be put to shame, for I take refuge in you. May integrity and uprightness protect me, because my hope, Lord, is in you. Deliver Israel, O God, from all their troubles.
All right, good morning. My name is Brandon, one of the pastors here. If you're new with us, we are in the middle of a series called Living from the Heart. Jesus, when he was asked by the religious leaders in the New Testament, what does God require of man? What is acceptable to God? What is required? What is our duty as human beings before God? He says two things. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Oftentimes, we're really good at loving God with our mind, being strong for God with our hands. But in order to love God with our hearts, we have to be dialed into the reality of our hearts. We have to know the kind of inner contours and shape of our hearts. And that can often be an area that feels very shapeless and shifty and scary, if we're honest, to be able to kind of go to those places where we're not comfortable. We don't have a grammar. We don't have a vocabulary. For some of us, it feels very foreign to kind of talk about emotions because we've been taught to be suspicious of emotions. And so therefore, there's a disconnect oftentimes in our relationship with God because we don't give ourselves permission to kind of bring our hearts before God and to really allow God to know our hearts, though he knows them already, but to know them with us knowing them. So, and then what that can do is that can inhibit our relationships with other people, where if I don't know myself, I can't really know God, and if I don't know God, I can't really know myself, and then if I don't know God or myself, I can't really know others and love others and trust others. And so the heart of really this series is to walk us into those scary places, to name those scary places, and to, in a sense, kind of reclaim our hearts and look at what does it then look like for us to live authentically and fully and freely from our hearts, to love God and to love our neighbor with all of our being, okay? And so this week, we are in Psalm 25, and we're talking about shame. And shame is one of those things that probably of all the emotions, we've talked about anger, we've talked about loneliness, we've talked about sadness, a number of different emotions, and we have a few more to go. I think of all the emotions, shame is the one probably that we're most intimately familiar with in our human experience, but probably least able to articulate to ourselves and other people what it really feels like to feel shame, to feel our shame, to own our shame, to be honest about our shame and to source our shame in a sense, to figure out where does it come from and how can that be productive for some of us and how can it be counterproductive for some of us. And so we're not really sure how to talk about it, and so we use different verbiage to talk about it. And it's compounded, this confusion is kind of compounded by the fact that we live in a world that in some ways has competing desires when it comes to shame and conflicting narratives. We're kind of trapped in this tension with shame. So just outside the church, kind of you just read and watch TED Talks, you watch what's kind of happening in literature around psychology. There's kind of two camps. On the one hand, you have people, and this would be characterized by, I think one psychologist put it best, a culture of the anti-shame zeitgeist. So there's an article in The Atlantic that kind of unpacks, so let me just break that down for a second, kind of unpacks this, and basically this movement sees shame as really destructive, always bad. It's a destructive force in society and with families and individuals, and so they want to drive out shame, right? And so you've got Brené Brown, one of the most popular TED Talks ever, 30 million views as of last night when I checked, talking about the power of vulnerability and how bad and how dark shame is. And shame needs to be kind of gotten rid of. In this article challenging the anti-shame zeitgeist, psychologist Joseph Burrow talks about this. Here's what he says. The consensus within our culture is clear. Shame is a uniquely destructive force and one to be resisted. Movie stars, educators, pop icons, psychologists, and spokespeople for the pride movements will all tell you the same thing. Shame is the enemy. It drives those individuals who are different into the shadows. It causes us to hide our vulnerability, distancing us from those we love. It enforces conformity and stifles the creative or dissident individual. It kills the spirit. That's how we kind of are taught to think about shame. And so the goal then becomes to drive out shame. And yet, we find that shame seems to stick to us. It seems to adhere to us as human beings. To be human is to be inescapably full of shame in some ways. As hard as we try to scrub it out or eliminate it from our lives or vanquish its effects in our hearts, the reality is it doesn't seem to leave. And no amount of kind of like positive thinking removes the shame from deep within. Charles Darwin actually pointed this out 150 or so years ago. He says, of all the core characteristics of human beings, and he pointed out nine, shame is that one that is universal in all cultures and all times and all places. And he asked the question, why has nature, in natural selection, not weeded out shame if it's so destructive for human beings? So even if you're here and you're not a Christian, just interesting things to think about in terms of how shame seems to be inevitable. And that's essentially the conclusion that he reaches in this article, is that shame is inevitable to the human condition. Because shame, he says, is the result of disappointed expectations. We feel shame when we have an expectation for something to happen, when we have an expectation for a relationship, and it doesn't come to fruition, or we feel like our parents didn't care for us the way that we wanted to. We have this kind of ideal vision of how our lives are going to go. We have these aches and longings to be known and to be loved and to be cherished and to be accepted. And then we find in our human experience and our brokenness in this world that that doesn't happen. And I don't care. I'm not just talking abuse here. I'm just saying, like, even those of us who grew up in relatively healthy families find that we carry deep shame inside of us. And so here is a non-Christian psychologist saying shame is inevitable. And at times, shame can even be productive, because shame points us to areas where there's dysfunction and there's toxicity in relationships. For instance, like, you ought to feel ashamed, right? If you're engaging in deviant behavior, you ought to feel ashamed if you're a pedophile. Like, that kind of shame leads you to a good place. So not all shame, he says, is bad. And then on the other hand, you have other people who are acknowledging that although there's this desire to drive out shame, kind of in line here, that we seem to, as a society, be comfortable profiting off of shame. So we live in this economy where shame becomes a voyeuristic pursuit. It becomes a click away. We live in what one psychologist calls a culture of humiliation, and we kind of enjoy, there's this dark side in us, and we don't like to admit this, but we kind of enjoy watching other people's shame. Like, what is reality TV but like the culture of humiliation, right? You watch other people get embarrassed, and then what do? That becomes your benchmark, and you're like, well, at least I'm not as weird as that. At least I'm not as bad as that. I would never, like, you're watching The Bachelor, right? You're watching The Bachelorette. Some of you dudes are watching that show. And you're saying, see, babe, I'm a better man than he is. So, you know, just kind of stop complaining so much. So we can enjoy being spectators to and profiting off the shame of others, and even to an extent, indulging in and profiting off our own shame. How many books are being written? I would call this like a faux authenticity movement, where it's like just cool to kind of like let people into all of your shame, and we become shameless, and then we write books glorying in our shamelessness, and they're bestsellers on the New York Times. Monica Lewinsky, probably the poster child for humiliation, this culture of humiliation with the internet over the past 25 or 30 years. She gave a TED Talk, again, another one that went viral. Here's what she said about this culture of humiliation. A marketplace has emerged where public humiliation is a commodity and shame is an industry. How is the money made? Clicks. The more shame, the more clicks. Now, I want to invite you, before you dismiss this, think about the last YouTube clip that you shared with somebody, that you texted to somebody or told somebody else to watch, probably involved somebody else being humiliated at someone's expense, okay? The more clicks, the more advertising dollars. She says, we are in a dangerous cycle. The more we click on this kind of gossip, the more numb we get to the human lives behind it. And the more numb we get, the more we click. See, this is the world that we live in. We don't know what to do with our shame. We have a desire to drive it out, and yet there's a dark side of us that's drawn to enjoy and indulge in and watch and profit off of other people's shame. There's this deep cultural longing to rid ourselves of toxic shame, and yet it seems to be intricately woven into the fabric of humanity in every culture, in every epoch of human history. And here's where it gets even harder for Christians, because we get really weird with shame. So let's just kind of own our own stuff. Let's go from outside the church to inside the church. Christians get weird with shame. We don't like to talk about shame in the church. I defy you to tell me anybody in this room maybe who's heard more than like two or three sermons in your life on shame in the church. Right? Like, we don't talk about shame. We don't have categories. Even though, and here's the crazy thing. All of us in this room, if you want to use a great visual, this is how I picture you guys this morning. Everybody carrying in a suitcase or a backpack full of the burden of shame, full of the acknowledgement that I am broken and that I feel inferior to other people. We bring that shame into this place, and all of us sit with shame this morning. Some of us, that's a backpack, because maybe we don't think about it that much, or we try to cover that shame. For some of us, I mean, it's a trailer that's just hitched to us, and we walk around all the time feeling shame, and yet we oftentimes don't even know how to articulate that, and then we go to church, and we have to what? Pretend. How are you doing? Great. Life's awesome, right? Retweet that, right? Like, that's how we live in the church. We don't have categories for talking about shame. We don't have a grammar or a framework for processing it or inviting others into it or inviting God into it, which is crazy because the Bible talks a lot about shame. Like, this kind of like anti-shame movement started in 1988. A guy wrote a book called Healing the Shame That Binds You. But like, you realize like the Bible for centuries has been talking about shame. There are 160 plus references in the Bible to shame. In the Psalms alone, a fourth of those, a little bit more than a fourth of those, 45 references to dealing with our shame. Why do we not talk about it in the church? Why are we afraid of shame? Probably because pastors like me and others are afraid of their own shame. We don't want to deal with our own shame. But we're afraid. We're afraid to talk about it. And yet the Bible offers us a comprehensive and realistic and hopeful understanding of shame that's going to be deeper and more resilient than anything you're going to watch in a TED Talk. And while I appreciate much of what's been written by people like Brené Brown and others, in my opinion, a lot of the conversation is one-dimensional. It's one-dimensional, and it lacks a bigger framework for understanding the true causes of shame, the purposes of shame, and the potential for healing in our shame. Shame is inescapable to the human condition. So we must face it. We must be honest about it. And we must learn to invite God into that space. As scary as it may be, as much as we may have been traumatized, that's the very space where God wants to meet us, transform us. Matter of fact, you will not be transformed if you can't be honest about your shame. if you carry it around, but you can't be honest about the reality of what's really happening in community, what's really happening in your soul, what's really happening in your marriage, what's really happening in your singleness, what's really happening in your body, you'll never be changed. You will stunt your growth, because to be human is to be fully human, emotional, physical, spiritual, relational. And so I want us to look together at shame, and I want us to develop a framework that's biblical for it, because again, the Bible talks about it a lot, and it gives us this really robust picture, this vision for what it looks like for us to acknowledge our shame and to bring our shame into the presence of God. Because that's like where we're going here, right? There's no surprise. If you read Psalm 25, David says, "To you, O God, do I bring my shame. To you do I lift up my soul. God, my confidence and my trust is in you. God, I'm afraid. I'm scared of the shame. But those who put their hope in the Lord will never be put to shame." And so let's look for a second at, and I want us to back up a second to Genesis chapter 3. Keep your thumb in Psalm 25, but I want to set this up by going back and looking at the origins of shame, because we need to put this in a broader narrative framework in the Bible, because shame doesn't start with David. Shame doesn't start with Psalm 25. Shame goes all the way back to the garden. In Genesis chapters 1 and 2, God creates a world of perfection. Out of the overflow of love and intimacy that God has in himself, and out of the joy of that community we call the Trinity, God creates all that is seen. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, "In the beginning, God. God created the heavens and the earth. He created mankind in his image for his glory." He creates a world that is supercharged with his abundance, with his generosity, with shalom, which shalom is this rich, multifaceted Jewish word that just means full flourishing. Everything accomplishes the end for which it's created. That's the idea. Everything's in harmony if you're a musician. Everything's in rhythm. There's no cacophony in Genesis chapter 1. And then not only does he do that with nature and creation, he does that with human beings. We call this the doctrine of the Imago Dei. God injects worth and dignity and value into human beings, and he creates us with a sense of glory. And in that space, we read at the end of Genesis chapter 2, verse 25, something that none of us have ever experienced but was true in the beginning, which is why we long for it, I think. Genesis chapter 2, verse 25, "The man and his wife were both naked." A lot of us long for that. "And they were not ashamed." You got to put those two together, okay? Naked and not ashamed. They were in the garden, but naked, physically, spiritually, emotionally, relationally. There was complete knowledge, and there was no pretense. There was no need to cover. There was no need to hide. There was no need to blame. There was no need to, like, you know, dull some of the edges. They were simply there in the garden in perfect relationship with God, and thus in perfect relationship and harmony with one another. But Genesis chapter 3 happens, right? In Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve decide at the invitation of the serpent that they don't want to trust God. God has one rule. He says, "Don't eat from the tree." And by the way, this is not like God is not against, you know, applesauce or apple eating or whatever that fruit was. We don't know what the fruit actually was. The rule was, "I'm God, you're not. You just obey me with respect to the tree, because I'm trying to establish my good and benevolent authority in your life, that the way that I see the universe is ultimate reality. I'm going to establish some healthy constraints and boundaries for you." And Adam and Eve choose to be their own lords, their own gods, their own saviors. They resist God's loving authority in their lives, and they decide to chart out their own path. And so Genesis chapter 3 recounts for us the disastrous effects of their decision. Verse 7, "After they eat of the tree, their eyes are opened, and they knew that they were naked." There's a new consciousness of nakedness. "And they sewed fig leaves together, and they made themselves loincloths to cover themselves, now that they knew that they were naked and ashamed. They heard the sound of God in the cool of the day. They hid themselves from God." And it goes on to recount how they then blame each other. So these are the consequences when sin enters the world. We have guilt in the garden. I've violated this law and this command. And then we have shame that begins to enter into the human story, which is, not only am I objectively guilty because I've violated a standard, now I'm aware that something's wrong. Not just did I do something wrong, I am wrong. I have done something, therefore I need to cover myself, I need to run from God, I need to hide from God because there's that terrifying nakedness. To be fully known, to be seen for who we really are. Not just physically. It's like not like God asks, where are you? It's not like God, you know, it's like a parent that loses their kid in a busy mall. It's not like God stepped into a clothing store and his kids like ran off and he's like, where'd you guys go? No, God is asking a relational question. Why have you abandoned my trust? Where are you? It's the same question he asks us today. Why have you run? Where are you? I've promised you life over here and yet you're hiding from me. Who told you that you were naked? That's the essence of shame. Shame is this subjective sense of nakedness before the eyes of another. Guilt and shame are different, and we're going to talk about guilt next week, okay? So we're going to spend a whole week talking about guilt, and we don't like to talk about guilt in our culture, but it is a reality. And so shame, though, is different. It's not just that I've failed and come short of this law or standard or norm. Shame is more about failing another person. Shame is this sense of being naked before the eyes of another. Shame arises when we feel vulnerable, when we feel exposed, when we feel unacceptable, when we feel unworthy, when we feel dirty. These are all symptoms of shame. And it oftentimes arises when we fail to live up to what psychologists call an ideal self, which I would just call like God's good imago Dei creative design. We know that we should be something else, and yet we find our experiences, we're down here somewhere, and that gap creates shame. So guilt and shame are similar, but they're different. And they can work together in good ways. They can come together, like I can do something wrong, and then I can feel ashamed. That's a shame that's positive and productive and healthy. Sometimes they work independently of each other. I can do something and be guilty but not feel ashamed. That's shamelessness. Or I can feel shame and actually not be guilty and have a false sense of guilt. Both of those things can be true at the same time. But when they begin to work against one another, things get really interesting. So think about, let me just give you a couple of examples. Think about the person that's trapped in pornography. 99.9% of men admit to looking at pornography at some point in their adult lives. The other 0.1% are liars. Okay, so we'll talk about lying in a second. But let's just say you're a Christian. You know, I shouldn't be looking at pornography. I shouldn't be going to these sites. I shouldn't be doing this while my wife is sleeping in the next room. I shouldn't be watching this program, but I am. So now I feel guilty because I violated a law, because there's all kinds of standards in the New Testament that tell you to flee, and the word there is actually porneia, flee immorality, which is attempting to gain satisfaction outside of the bonds and the covenant of marriage. Any of that, all of that is just a junk drawer category for pornography. So whatever that looks like for you, seeking stimulation outside of the covenant of marriage, whatever that looks like, you do it, and then shame comes in. And then what happens is you begin to say things like, I'm a Christian. I didn't think I was the kind of person that looked at pornography. Or I teach a Bible study for other men. Or I teach children, and I work with children. I shouldn't be doing this, and yet I am. What does that say about me? Not only did I make a mistake, then we begin to internalize that criticism. I am a mistake. I am an adulterer, right? Or take lying. Like, let's go a little bit more innocuous, right? Maybe seemingly innocuous. You tell a lie, and it's like, okay, I shouldn't have told that lie, and then you justify why you're okay telling that lie, because all of us find our little exemption clauses, right? And then you begin to say, oh my gosh, you get convicted. I'm not the kind of person who tells lies. And what's crazy is we kind of like have this thing we do, this self-talk where it's like, well, that wasn't really me. You ever done that? Like you committed some kind of infraction or a sin. You lied. Like, well, that's not the real me. The real me is really kind and loving. But look at, like, it is the real you. It is really you. You wanted something that you couldn't have, and you deceived somebody else to get it. Or to avoid the consequences of doing something, you told a lie. Therefore, you are a liar. You see how that shame begins to kind of get magnified. So let me give you a real simple definition of shame from Dan Allender and Trimper Longman in their book, Cry of the Soul. They say, shame is the traumatic exposure of nakedness. This exposure occurs when we feel the lance of a gaze, either someone else's or our own, tearing open the various cultural, relational, or religious coverings we put on. And what is revealed in that moment he says, we feel, is an inner ugliness. You ever sent a text message to the wrong person? Then you know what it's like to feel exposed and naked. You ever sent it to the person you were talking about? When I was a kid, we had corded telephones, and we used to have to go like back into a bedroom and hide so that like our little brothers and sisters wouldn't hear our conversations. Did you ever like talk about your brother or sister or talk about somebody only to discover, because they always kind of outed themselves eventually, you'd be like, like you'd hear the breathing on the other end, you realize, oh, but my sister's on the phone right now. That's terrifying. We can kind of laugh about that with these, but like that sense of really being known, really being discovered, really being outed, that is what it feels like to feel shame. I found it interesting when I lived in South Florida, this played itself out with Haitian brothers and sisters that we had in our church who had escaped the poverty of Haiti and yet felt all kinds of shame and would send lots of money home to support family. And it's interesting, there's a great little essay if you want to read it. Edwidge Danticat is a Haitian Creole writer, and she has this little essay called Create Dangerously. And she talks about how Haitians in the year 2008 sent $8 billion of money back to their folks. And largely, most of it was driven by a sense of guilt and shame. I feel ashamed because I've escaped this life of poverty. And maybe some of us know what that looks like here in the States. I've escaped this poverty, and yet my family's back in Haiti. Like that kind of shame. How about parenting a difficult or a disabled child? There's some shame in that, right? Like we kind of normalize, like you hear people say when they're pregnant, we have lots of pregnant folks, and so I'm not gonna shame you if you say this and make it worse, but like, I just want a healthy baby. What does healthy mean? Does it mean a kid with autism? Does it mean a kid with Down syndrome? And what if my baby happens to have one of those chromosomal abnormalities? Or what if they happen to have emotional struggles? You know what it's like to feel completely isolated and alone with a child who struggles? And you show up at church. I mean, we have some folks here at our church whose kids have autism, couldn't go to church for years because they would show up at a church and say things like, you're not disciplining your kids the right way. Well, we don't have programs for kids like yours here. Thank God that Robin and our team have the Buddies program, which come alongside these kids who are made in the image of God, to love them and remind them that they are special and that they matter to God. But the shame of being a parent. One writer, Emily, I forget her last name, she has this great little parable poem called Welcome to Holland. And in this poem, it's well known, if you have kids with disabilities, you may have read this poem, but she talks about being a parent of a child that struggles is like packing your bags and thinking you're going to Italy and the plane lands in Holland. And everybody's coming out off the plane in Italy talking about how amazing it is, how beautiful the scenery is, how good the food is, how sweet the Italian people are, and you're stuck in Holland. All kinds of shame that we carry in our experience as human beings. What triggers shame? Let's look in Psalm 25. David gives us some sources for our shame. And I don't know what that looks like for you. I don't know what it is that energizes your shame. I don't know what it is that triggers your shame, that awakens your shame. But I know if you're human, you have it. David gives us a couple different causes. Notice verse 1. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in you I put my trust. Let me not be put to shame. Let not my enemies exult over me. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. They will be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. And he goes on to describe the violence of enemies. So sometimes our shame is triggered by what other people do to us, right? What other people do to us. And this is the category we're probably most familiar with because this is the one that our culture kind of lives in. Shame is the result of a bad childhood. Shame is the result of what other people do to us. And I'm not taking that away from anybody because that is a real thing. Doing lots of marriage counseling, doing lots of counseling with singles in our church. I know that many of you have been victimized, you've been assaulted, you've been dehumanized, you have been marginalized, you've been excluded from different groups because of all kinds of reasons. You grew up in a home where you were abused, and that is legitimate, and I don't want to take that away from anybody. Sometimes people do things to us. David, the king of Israel, the most powerful human being in Israel, says, I experience shame because my enemies exult over me. They literally mock me. They scorn me. They show contempt for me. They ridicule me. They're violent against me. Shame, ironically, leads us to be violent. Either violent against ourselves, oftentimes abusers are people themselves who feel deep shame. And then they carry that shame, and then they project that shame on other people, trying to deal and cover with their own shame. David says, I have enemies, and that's real. Sometimes shame comes from things that are done to us. Sometimes David also says, and this is where we got to get beyond just the shame that we feel because of what's happened to us, whether that's disappointing relationships or actual abuse, both of which are very real. He says, not only are things done to me, sometimes we do things to ourselves. Sometimes we've done things to other people. Sometimes all of us have done things against God. We've sinned against God. Notice what he says here later on down in this passage, verse 6. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been from old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness, O Lord. Verse 11, for your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my guilt, for it's great. He says, don't remember the sins of my youth. Sometimes we do things. And man, some of us are living in shame from decisions we made a long time ago. And it's easy for us just to blame other people. It's easy for us to shake our fists at the man, to shake our fists at systems, to shake our fists at perpetrators, without realizing that sometimes we're not always the victims. We are actually the perpetrators. We're not always the oppressed. We are also simultaneously, as Albert Camus, the famous philosopher, not a Christian, pointed out, oftentimes those who are oppressed in their anger, in their shame, rise to power in revolution and actually become the very oppressors they were revolting against. And many of us do that. We are both the shamed and the shamers. We shame other people. We look down on other people. We think we're better than other people. We shame ourselves. We live in this self-contempt because of our guilt, because of the sense that I've done something wrong and I feel that I am wrong. Like all of that's packaged up. And so sometimes we do things, and the reason that we're suffering, the reason that we have shame is because of our own decisions. And then finally, he says, not only do we have things done to us, not only do we do things to others, there's just a basic incompleteness to us as human beings. There's a sense of inadequacy that floods our hearts where we know that we don't have what it takes. We know we don't measure up to the standard. We know that we don't have what it takes to be for ourselves and to be for other people and to be for God what we want to be. So notice what David says in verse 4. And again, keep in mind, this is the king of Israel with all resources and power at his disposal. Verse 4, make me to know your ways, O Lord. The implication is I don't know your ways. I'm incompetent. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. I'm weak and I need to be rescued, he says. For you I wait all the day long. David's saying, I'm not sufficient. I don't have what it takes. I need your wisdom. I need your deliverance. I need your help. I need something from you that I cannot provide for myself. Even in the garden, where there's all this shalom and benediction, there's a basic incompleteness. Do you remember the one malediction in the book of Genesis in the early chapters? It's not good for man to be alone. Even in the garden, there was a sense of incompleteness. We needed each other, and we needed and still need God. And that basic sense of inadequacy, man, just beats us down. And so we have all kinds of shame that we carry around. Let me just give you like a quick catalog of things that in my own experience and talking to people in my own life where this basic sense of incompleteness and inadequacy that has nothing to do with anything that anybody's done to us. It has nothing to do really with things that we've done to ourselves. It's just this nagging sense that we don't measure up, that we're inadequate, that we're incomplete. Like some of us have shame about our bodies, our body type, our body shape, how tall we are. You know, I'm 5'10", and I walk around with, you know, kind of like a short man's complex, wishing I was 6'10". For those of you who are tall, good for you, you know, but like, we can feel shame about our height, or maybe some of you that are tall are like, I wish I was short, because being tall, you know, being like 7 foot is not always a gift. I know we have some big dudes in our church, some taller women in our church, and it's not always good, so you can feel shame about that. You can feel shame about the color of your skin. I have dark brown skin, even within, like, minority groups. There's an interesting article about Steph Curry a couple months ago in The Undefeated on ESPN, talking about different shades of African-Americans and how there's shame with darker-skinned African-Americans versus lighter-skinned African-Americans. The color of my skin can make me feel less than somebody else. My gender, I'm a woman, or I'm a man, or I'm in some fluid category between the two, I don't even know what I am, can create shame. My hair, whether my hair is curly or thin or full or volumized or whatever, I can feel shame about my hair and wish that I had somebody else's. My net worth, my intelligence, my physical capacities, my ability emotionally to be anxious or not anxious or to nail it in my workplace, my weight, right? My athletic ability, my home. There's all kinds of like home shaming going on, you know what I mean? Like Instagram, like I've got to have this kind of home. Or else I'm not really significant. Where you grew up? I grew up in Kentucky. You guys shame me all the time. What kind of accent you have? Yeah. What kind of accent that you have? Where you grew up, the small town you grew up in, the family that you grew up in. You're the son or daughter of somebody else, and that gets, you know, imputed to you. That reputation can create shame. Where you send your kids to school or don't send your kids. There's public school shaming. There's private school shaming. There's charter school shaming. And I feel really bad if you're a homeschool family. There is a ton of homeschool shaming. The foods you eat, GMO, non-GMO, baked with coconut flour, whatever, political affiliations, cause shaming. How about cause shaming? If you don't click on this right now, if you don't retweet this right now, if you don't like this right now, you don't care about the poor. And there's a million things to click on. There's a million things to get involved in to express yourself. Or you're just like, dude, I don't even like Twitter. I don't even like Instagram. I love the poor. I just don't like social media. And yet you feel shame because you're not on there and you're not in the cause. These are all different ways and things that can trigger our shame. I don't know what that looks like for you, but I bet that you spend a lot of time, and I bet that you spend a lot of creative energy and a lot of your imagination and a lot of your money doing the same thing that Adam and Eve tried to do in Genesis chapter 3 to deal with their shame. We hide from it. Now, we might not do that physically. We might present ourselves as strong. We might CrossFit. And again, every time I say this, somebody thinks I'm like knocking on CrossFit. I'm not knocking on spike ball. If you're a triathlete, whatever, you know, Matt, like, awesome. I'm so thankful you guys want to do that. But it can be a way that we seek to cover our shame. We can be physically strong and yet be hiding emotionally. You know what it's like to hide emotionally when you show up at coffee with someone and you control the narrative? You control how much information they're allowed to see. And there's even a fake like authenticity thing within Christianity where I can show you some of my respectable sins, but I'm not gonna let you into the basement of my shame. You know what I'm talking about? Fake authenticity, pseudo authenticity. I'm gonna let you see a little bit of my anger, a little bit of my fear, just enough so you know, like there's a great parody of this on YouTube, like a Christian video. I'm gonna throw up my tattoo so that you know I have a past. But I'm not gonna show you what's in my heart. We can hide from it. We can try to cover it. We can try to numb it with substances. We can try to cover it with all kinds of money. We can try to cover it with anger and bitterness and resentment. We can cover it with drivenness. Drivenness, like if I study harder, if I work harder, then I'll be something, then I'll matter. And it's driven by shame. Like you can be really successful, and that can be rooted in shame. Because if I don't do this, then I'm not going to be a better man than my dad, whom I hate. Not speaking, my dad's here. I love my dad, but like, let's say that's you. How about like you can use religion that way to cover? It's fig leaves. I'm gonna show up at church. I'm gonna serve in the kids' ministry. I'm gonna do the work, you know, the ministry nobody else wants to do, so nobody will ask me or question my credentials when it comes to my Christianity. I'm gonna do more Bible studies. I'm gonna show up at a women's group. I'm gonna go to a men's conference. All of these can be ways that we cover shame. Shame is like this app that runs in the background of our smartphones. And it exhausts and drains and triggers anxiety, but it leaves us feeling tired. Like how many of you are just exhausted from trying to manage your shame or trying to deny your shame? But despite our best intentions, we can't. You can't cover it. Or the last response is blame. You just blame other people. The reason that I am the way that I am is because of my father. The reason that I am the way that I am is because of my mother. The reason I am the way that I am is because of my sister or my brother or this professor that I had or this person that abused me. And again, I'm not minimizing your pain by any means. But to allow someone to have that kind of control in your life means that you are totally indulging shame. And you're making shame the thing that you really worship rather than God. So what is God's invitation in all this? What do we do with our shame? It's like heavy. Like everybody, I can feel this, like the air just went out. Like the air's out of the room. Everybody's ready to go see a counselor. What do we do with our shame? Because there's good news here. David gives us good news, and it's not just some bumper sticker, you know, let go and let God. That's not what David does here. Okay, David invites us into a deep place. He invites us to experience deep healing from our shame, not to completely get rid of our shame, but to see the gain of shame, to see that shame can lead us to deeper places. It's like smoke that wants to lead us to the fire. And where David goes with his shame is the same place that we need to go with our shame, into the presence of God, into the presence of God, in deep communion with God. Notice David cries out in the midst of his shame. He says, I'm not going to ignore this. I'm not going to try to cover this. I'm not going to try to fix this shame. It's real and it's there and it's terrifying. But to you, oh Lord, I lift up my soul. God, take my shame. I lift up my heart to you. I want you to see all of it in all of its ugliness. God, take all my shame. Oh God, he says, in you I trust. Let me not be put to shame. And he says with confidence in verse 3, indeed, none who wait for you will be put to shame. Who's going to be put to shame, he says, are those who are enemies of God, who are wantonly treacherous. They will be put to shame. But he says, not me. Notice verse 13. The man or the woman who brings their shame before God, he says, that person's soul will abide in well-being. Literally, the word there, abide, is a really cool word. It means to spend the night with. He'll abide in God's presence. He will have God as his habitation, as his dwelling place, as his safety, as his confidence or her confidence. We take it into the presence of God because God's not afraid of our shame. God knows what to do with our shame. God knows how to take our shame, which is part of what it means to be human, and to heal us and to redeem us and to transform us. Shame has a gain to it. God uses in his kindness shame to awaken things in us, to awaken longings and hungers and desires. Let me just give you two things that God can awaken in you through your shame if you will bring it into his presence. God awakens humility in us when we acknowledge our shame. Notice verse 9, he leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. When we acknowledge our shame, it leads us to confession. Forgive me, God, my guilt is great. It exposes our false trusts. Because a lot of times we feel shame because we care about somebody else's approval of us. We care too much about somebody else's acceptance over us. And so we spend our lives hungry for attention and hungry for intimacy and hungry for relationship. And God says, don't put your trust in human beings. They will always fail you. I don't care how great your mom was. She will fail you. I don't care how awesome your dad is. He will fail you. So the invitation is to just let shame create humility in us, create dependence in us, so that we cry out to God in our shame, and we can acknowledge our weaknesses. We can acknowledge our idolatries. We can acknowledge our limitations. I am a limited person who needs other people. And sometimes when I need other people, because I am human, I get hurt. But I don't stop needing other people. I don't shut the door of my heart to real relationships. So it leads us to humility, to cry out to God, God, I need you and I need other people. It's inescapable. And then it leads to compassion. Because now if I can acknowledge that I'm broken, if I can acknowledge my story and my pain, now I can look at you and I can say, I'm no better than you. It creates empathy, it creates compassion and solidarity between human beings. Because in our pride sometimes and in our shame, we actually think that we're better than other people. I would never do that. And so shame becomes this little warm blanket for the soul. And the invitation is to let go of that, to see I am as capable of harming and shaming other people as they are of harming and shaming me. So let's just all acknowledge that. And let's be reminded that God created us as image bearers. Back to Genesis 3. With equal dignity and value and worth. And so may it never be said of Christians that we would willfully shame other people because of their skin color, because of their socioeconomic status, because of their body shape, because they don't have the resources that we have, or the education that we have. Martin Luther King Jr. said this way better than I can. He said, the whole concept of the image of God is the idea that all men have something within them that God injected. And this gives him a uniqueness, it gives him worth, it gives him dignity, and we must never forget this. There are no gradations in the image of God. Every man from a treble white to a bass black is significant on God's keyboard, precisely because every man is made in the image of God and every woman. One day we will learn that. We will know one day that God made us to live together as brothers and to respect the dignity and worth of every man. We're still not there. But as we acknowledge these things, God begins to awaken humility and compassion in us, to move us outward, to care about others. Verse 22, David ends this by saying, redeem Israel, God. I know that I've got wounds and I know that I'm afraid and I have my shame, but God, would you redeem Israel? God, get me outside of myself to see your bigger plan. Close with this as we go to communion. God doesn't just invite us to see our shame. God deals with our shame. That's what communion is really all about. It's a reminder that God is for us, that he invites us into his presence with our shame, that he covers our shame. All throughout the Bible, one of the big themes that you'll see when it comes to shame is that shame is like this nakedness where we don't want to be seen, we don't want to be exposed, but we are, that we're always standing before the eyes, not only of other human beings and our neighbors, but we're always before the eyes of God. God sees everything. He knows everything. We do not deceive God. God is not mocked. But God reaches out to us in our shame, and he continues to pursue us. I mean, do you notice like the language David's using here? The one who fears the Lord is his friend. God's a friend to shameful people. God's a friend to victims. God's a friend to guilty sinners like us. Absolutely. That's why he sent Jesus into this world. In Ezekiel 16, we want to read about it. In Hosea 4, they kind of are forerunners of what God's going to do in the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. In Ezekiel 16, God says, in our shame, we're like babies that have been thrown into a field that are wallowing in our own blood. And that's a graphic picture. But he says God takes his covers, his robe, his garment, and spreads them over us to cover our nakedness. In Romans chapter 4, it says that he gives us garments of salvation, garments of righteousness. He imputes his righteousness into our lives. 1 John chapter 3, he adopts us into his family. See what great love the Father has for us. He lavishes on us with his love, with his grace, with his kindness. He gives us dignity. He gives us mercy. He gives us friendship. He accepts us, not just as we are, but as we will be in Jesus. He says everything that's been done, Jesus took our shame in his body. He bore it on the cross. He was shamed. He was scorned. He was mocked in his body, bearing the weight of our shame so that we could be set free. And that's the essence of communion, that God invites us to reimagine and reinterpret our stories in light of what Jesus has done for us, to redeem our imaginations. And so as you come to communion, I just want to invite you to stop for a moment and to do that. Just take a moment, and I want you to imagine your shame. Like, really do it. Like, hold it before you. What is that thing that causes you to feel unlovable, unworthy of God's grace? You know what it is. It's probably right there. Go ahead and just imagine that. And then I want you to feel it, to really feel that as a gift from God to drive you to repentance, to expose your heart. And then I want you to feel Jesus covering that shame. Covering that shame, that specific thing. He is for you. He has purchased your cleansing, your redemption, your forgiveness. You don't have to carry that weight. You can literally fling it on him, as 1 Peter says, cast all of your cares on him, cast all of your worries on him. Those who trust in the Lord never have to be put to shame. Bring that right here to communion, the body of Jesus, broken for your shame, the blood of Jesus shed to cleanse you of all shame. And let's come in that imagination, and then let's look forward to this week and to the next days to come and say, what would it look like for me to live in the freedom of that kind of glory, having the acceptance of God? Because then it doesn't matter like what my parents think. Then it doesn't matter what my siblings think or what my boss thinks. It matters what God thinks. And if God is for me, as Paul says, who can be against me? So let's take a moment, let's pray. Let's ask for God's kindness and his mercy and his grace as we enter these scary places. And let's seek the Lord together and be reminded of his great love for us. As we do this, if you're a Christian, we'd invite you to come. If you are placing your hope in Jesus for fullness of life and joy and satisfaction and salvation, that's what it means to be a Christian. Not that you have it all together, you still have shame, but to carry that shame and to know what to do with that shame, to bring it to God. If you're not a Christian, we'd invite you to stay in your seat as this meal's taken. This is a family meal to be shared by those who are hoping in Jesus to set them free. So we have stations in the front, stations in the back. You take time to pray to God and then come as you're ready. Father, thank you for your mercy and your kindness, that you meet us in our shame, that you know what it's like to be shamed. God, you sent Jesus to live a perfect life, and for that he was crucified and killed and put to open shame. But thank you, Jesus, that in Colossians 2, it tells us that while the world thought they were shaming Jesus, while the wise and the strong thought that they were shaming God, you are putting the principalities and powers that animate our shame to death. You are putting them to open shame, humiliating them, mocking them, scorning them, defeating them once and for all. So God, you've done all these things, as Hebrews chapter 12 says, and Hebrews chapter 2 says, that so that you're not ashamed to call us your brothers and sisters in Christ. You scorned the cross and endured its shame to set us free, to lead us into glory and joy and happiness. And so, God, I pray that that would be our declaration as we come to you today, that we would come as accepted and dearly loved children. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.